those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, good morning. I'm Herb and welcome to Community Spotlight. Each week I invite somebody to come in and talk about their journey or a local organisation or an event. And this morning I have an event and it's an exhibition at Nerham called How to Weather Together. And I've got Jen Hamilton from UNE, from the Humanities, Arts and Social Science. Good morning, Jen.
Hi, Herb. How's it going?
I'm very well, very well. Now, you tell me you've come from Sydney about 8 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I got a job at UNE 8 years ago. I was living in Sydney, working at Sydney Uni, and applied for a job up here and moved my whole family up here and haven't looked back.
And you're born in Wollongong?
I was born in Wollongong.
What was living in, well, growing up in Wollongong like?
Oh, wow.
Coastal experience?
It was actually extremely coastal. My childhood home was 50 metres from the beach, but also about a kilometre downwind of the steelworks and coal loader. So I dread to think what I inhaled as a child, but it was like you look one direction, it was this idyllic kind of lighthouse and beautiful beach scene, and look the other way and it was kind of an industrial hellscape. And I'm sure that that upbringing kind of in the live environment of Dharawal country, but also like in the shadow of industrial capitalism was like an influence in me becoming an environmental person later in life.
Very good. I remember doing a dive out off where the loader is in Wollongong and a denuded landscape of rocks and not much else and sea urchins.
Oh, in Port Kembla? Sort
yeah,
of. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. There wasn't anything else there.
Oh, my God. That's. I mean, I wonder, like, there's been a lot of kind of coastal restoration in recent years, so I wonder if the life has come back a little bit as the industry's wound back a little bit.
That was 40 years ago, though.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been at the peak, really, in the 80s.
Well, yeah, it was in the 80s. So let's get to the How to Weather Together exhibition, and there is a book related to that, and we'll mention it at the end. Tell me about how did you get into this field of weathering together and climate change?
Yeah, there's a bit of a story to that, I guess. Where to begin? I mean, I obviously began in my childhood just then, but just to kind of like fast forward a little bit to being a student at university, I ended up doing a PhD on the storm in Shakespeare's King Lear, which is an iconic tragedy, and looked at the representation of the storm over the centuries, like how the representation of that scene changed and what it meant, and then kind of bringing it up to the present, what it means in a time of climate change, and also sort of how the meaning of the storm has shifted, like how the text itself gives off all of these different possible interpretations. And so I got really interested in thinking about weather really critically and poetically. And then moving, once you finish your PhD, it's like, well, what are you going to do? And I met an academic from Canada who just moved to Sydney called Astrina Naimanis. And she'd just written a kind of philosophical paper called Weathering with another scholar, Rachel Lowen Walker. And we sort of compared notes. I talked about my work on weather in literature and she talked about her theories of weathering and philosophy. And we just started to collaborate. And from there, really, this book and exhibition, How to Weather Together, is a culmination of that decade-long collaboration.
So tell me, you use the word weathering and weather very often in your sentence. Tell me what that word means to you, because weathering to me is the process of sand and wind and rain decomposing soil and rock. But yes. What does it mean?
Great question. I mean, it means that in the book there's two chapters, one chapter's weather, one chapter's weathering. So I'm going to try to give you the most brief answer possible. Weathering means exactly what you said too. It's part of the rock cycle. It's part of soil production. Weathering is also just a common word for like getting through something that's difficult but pulling through safely. But in that article, Weathering, from 2014, Astrida and her collaborator, Lowen Walker, talk about it as a concept to describe how we humans weather climate change. And so it's kind of borrowing from soil ecology and from geology, this slow transformation that occurs over time. So our bodies, we live however long you live. Lucky if we can live till our life expectancy in this place. You know, our bodies change over time, not just in response to like genetic conditions but response to environmental conditions. And so they use the concept weathering to describe how climate change is experienced by us, even though it's a big thing at big scale. You know, it's melting ice caps and rising sea levels and biodiversity loss. It's a whole bunch of things, but we also experience it in our bodies. So weathering is a term that kind of brings the big scale of climate change into thinking about our body. So it's kind of a neologism or an adaptation of other meanings of weathering into a specific application for our own kind of creative play. And that's the great thing about language, I guess. The meaning of words can change over time.
So while we're in that space of theorising, Albert Einstein, back in the day, talked about the connection of all living things and non-living things, the web of life. Humans have the ability to operate, they think, outside that space of that connection, and often with unintended outcomes. So we can see those quite... A simple one might be the loss of beach sands from beaches when a human builds rock walls. Or we might see pollution in an estuarine system from chemical use upstream on the coastal floodplain. If we acknowledge that climate change is a human-induced response to our activities, how then that Albert Einstein thing, the connection of things in the web of life, how can we actually connect back in to that web of life and actually not have some of those unintended outcomes?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question, Herb. I love it. And I think there's a number of possible answers. I mean, one is that we're on Indigenous country, and I'm not an Indigenous person, but learning from Indigenous folks like Uncle Steve Widders, who's, you know, an elder here, and I'm an elder, you learn about country and the connection between all living things and non-living things and human bodies and animal bodies and, you know, and that, so that knowledge is already of this place. But as a non-Indigenous person, I grew up in an education system where I didn't necessarily learn that that was the relationship between humans and nature. I learned about a distinction, like humans do these things and nature does these things, and we just basically try to keep nature at bay and control it for our own whims. And so for me, one aspect of this is a kind of process of unlearning that colonial way of viewing nature as separate and trying to learn from Indigenous knowledges and Indigenous people about that more integrated way of viewing all things, but also not trying to just take from that and, you know, use it for your own purposes. It's like, how can you learn in that way and also try to repair those harms that colonialism has caused? That's a big question. Another kind of thread of my work comes through feminist philosophy, which, like, in the history of philosophy, there's, like, a very strong mind-body split, right? So philosophy all happens up in the head. The body's just like a problem, really, the problem of the vulnerable animal body. It's like we want to forget about that and think about the kind of glorious possibilities of the mind to transcend the body. But, you know, not only feminist philosophy, but feminist philosophy really specifically does kind of say, well, what about the body? How does the body relate to the mind? How does the fact that we're all kind of born of a body and the fact that we all die relate to our minds and relate to the broader environments that we're part of? And so it's those kind of two traditions that really inform my thinking. How do we get away from it? I think, to get back to your question, how do we get away from that separation? I think it's a slow process, right? Like, it's not something that I learned overnight. It's not something that I've fully unlearned. And, you know, we live in this world that really does pride ourselves on the distinction between the mind and the body, the distinction between nature and culture. So we have to kind of navigate it slowly. And this is why I like the concept of weathering, because it's like, this is not easy work to unscramble the egg, basically. And so I think that our work is like trying to do that slow erosion of those oppositions.
So, yeah, when I think about this climate change, I think there's a whole lot of people who don't believe that it's human-induced. And I think if we took responsibility for our actions as a human species, going back to that Albert Einstein web of life connection, if we actually took responsibility for it, that might be the first step in acknowledging that all these other things and agricultural activities on the Western Plain, for example, example out here around our area, loss of species, loss of vegetation communities, all because of agricultural production. Now, that's happened, but we have to acknowledge that we are responsible for those things. And the outcome is we don't have those species or communities anymore. And there's a lot of examples in across Australia of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the question of responsibility is a really interesting one because it connects up with how we feel about who's responsible. You know, like if you have a conflict with a friend, right, you're like, well, it was their fault that this happened. Like it's hard to take your own responsibility, but in something this vast, it's like who's the like biggest player that if they started to take responsibility, then maybe sort of other things would flow, you know. And I mean, obviously I think my politics are probably becoming clear, but I think it's sort of like big corporations that probably have the most power to take responsibility, but because of the system that we live in, profit over planet is kind of still driving things. So it's hard for corporations to take responsibility and still be economically viable. So I think where you see the responsibility being taken most directly is in small communities, like in a grassroots way. There's so many people trying to take responsibility for the problem. It's just there's a lot of inertia in the system.
So this might be a bit of a can of worms, Pandora's box. But if we talk about the big power generators, and we've been fed power from the coal-fired power stations all around the country, and they are now moving into those renewable energy sectors and providing us, and there's government policy, is that in some way them taking responsibility and moving away, or is it just because they're being forced to?
Gosh, I mean, I'm really not an expert on energy policy, and I'm involved in the organisation Sustainable Living Armidale, and we're having a conversation in the group about this now, you know, like how do we link up with the renewable energy zone, and like are the companies and corporations that are part of the renewable energy zone actually ethical companies, or are they just kind of profiteering off, you know, renewables in the same way they were profiteering off fossil fuels? And I think for me, I'm actually just trying to figure that out. I don't have the answer. I do think, though, that the profit imperative and the growth imperative are what drives climate change, really, like because you have to kind of skim off the top. So you're skimming off the top not only of people, but also places. And that really things like degrowth are probably models to think about. Yeah, but I don't know if big energy companies are really going, oh yeah, let's like prioritise degrowth for the 2026 financial year.
You might tell us what degrowth is.
It's where the economy is based on kind of not growing. And it might not necessarily be about not flourishing. It's about just kind of not keeping on extracting more and more. Like if you think about, I think, fast fashion shops, right? It's not about feeding more things into the system. It's like, how can we have an economy that meets our needs but doesn't actually rely on relentless expansion for that meeting of our needs? And it's a big open question. There's lots of research being done in this area at the moment. It's not my area. That's why I'm kind of avoiding the heart of the question a little bit, because we probably need a bit more information.
Well, I think that capitalist society has a problem, is one of the things that's responsible in that way. So let's just move on. I think we've theorised a fair bit. And there's probably a fair bit we could. Let's go to the exhibition. Now, you tell me it's running from the 7th of November to the 2nd of February. So it's a long exhibition. So you can get along to it. It's free entry. And it's in the Mazda Gallery in the foyer. Now, tell me, what are the works that people will see? So you've collaborated with this one with Rachel down there at Rachel Parsons at NERAM to put this together. So tell me about each of the works, and then why did you select those artists?
This exhibition's been an interesting one to put together because it's linked to this book, and it's like, well, what do we want to actually represent for audiences? What do we want them to kind of experience? And I think that's kind of changed over the process. It's evolved. And so there's so many works that could go in it. And just before we went on air, and I'm sure you'll bring this up, Herb, but you were talking about artists that could have been thematically linked with this exhibition. So the exhibition contains the centrepiece of the exhibition is a series of hand-drawn hand-drawn originally, but then printed, like basically print works on paper that explore different practices for weathering together. And these practices are in the book as insets. And so we've turned them into an artwork and an art book to put in the exhibition. And so there are 10 practices that are about embodying the weather, you know, like getting curious about how your body relates to the weather, writing poetry about ambient kind of atmospheres of the room, thinking about the objects that you have in your life that help you manage the weather. And once you start doing that, you realize that actually the weather's in a lot of objects that we have, a lot of the buildings that we have, you know, it's everywhere. And then kind of practices for, like, so those kind of creative practices, and then meditation, like a sitting practice. And they're all visually represented in these insets. So that's going to be on one wall. And the illustrator for that was Tessa Zettel, who Astrida and I have collaborated with for a really long time. And so that's kind of a collaboration between us as academics and Tessa as an artist. Then there's a couple of works that Tessa, Astrida and I have done individually in different ways. So a work that I did in 2011 before I was collaborating with both of them is called Walking in the Rain. And it was a walk along the Cooks River in Sydney. And so I have sort of an archive of that work, some costumes, some photographs from that work, just as a sort of backstory to how I got into weather, but also about weather and stormwater management. And I guess walking in the rain is kind of a joyful activity. So it's about bringing, you know, it's all like doom and gloom. There's a lot of doom and gloom in climate change thinking. But for me, there is also like joy and pleasure in being out in the weather, being out in nature.
Yes and no. I remember the early days in Sydney Harbour and how filthy the harbour was. And I remember walking around where the Olympic Park is back then in the 80s and in the rain, and the amount of sediment that was being dropped into the ocean, the amount of plastics and bags and dead fish and things like that. So thankfully the harbour's been cleaned up with taking all those petrochemicals out and paint products and things. So, yeah, it sort of, to me, it brings up a whole different memory.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, the Cooks River is an interesting site like that too. And there's been a lot of research done on the industrial history, the colonial history of the Cooks River, because it was, you know, for Bedjigal and Gadigal mob, a food bowl, right? You could eat there, fish there, camp there. I lived just on a kind of plateau above the Cooks River, and there was a midden in our backyard basically, because, and some like hand Aboriginal art on the rocks behind our house, because like it was just a place where people were. But then it was dammed and there was heavy industry on the river, and the silt at the bottom of the river is like full of these chemicals still, like they can't get them fully out. And I think that's a great point, because we think about it sort of in this nature culture split. We think about nature as this pristine place separate to like the messy, dirty city. But actually, industrialization and where we're at in the world now, like there is no place that's untouched by this kind of toxic sludge, and we have to learn to kind of live within it.
Yes, in essence, we're only viewing our environment that we see through our eyes and our other senses. We're only seeing what's there at this present point in time. Everybody else that came before us has impact on it. You know, whether you want to keep it for future generations, that's the question that we should be asking ourselves. What do we want our future local environment to look like? What are we passing on? And many, many, many people is that we say have said that you use the environment or you look after the environment to give it to the next generation. But a lot of people don't see that as being the fundamental driver in what they should be doing. It's this capitalist drive to extort as much economic return out of it as possible.
Yeah.
I think we're going down this rabbit hole. Let's get back to the pieces in the
works. Exhibition. So, yeah, there's that Walking in the Rain piece. And then Tessa Zettel and her collaborator, Susie Nelson, did these beautiful projects where they, for a month, recorded everything that they composted in their house and then made a set of cards that link up with that practice. And like, it's just a beautiful, it's like aesthetically quite a beautiful object, but also it represents this slow like practice over a month of being really intentional about how you manage your waste in the house. So it's not just about, you know, composting, which obviously is a great sustainability practice. It's how can that be enjoyed and reflected on really deeply. So the compost cards are going to be in the exhibition, and they're also an object of art for sale. Astrida, with other artists, Arnie Rhonda Dixon and Claire Britton, did a walk called The River Ends as the Ocean. And so there's going to be a video work and maybe some objects from that project. There is some drawings by Brisbane-based artist Henry van Noordenberg called Time of the Signs, and he does movement performances, and then does a drawing kind of based on that. And it's sort of like, so it's like a type of drawing that wants to capture that embodied experience of movement. And I think that really connects up with what Weathering's about, like really trying to think about the body in time and space. And another Brisbane-based artist, Ray Haynes, has some beautiful print works called Climate Targets, which are kind of almost like political posters, but really aestheticized, about the fact that, like, even though, like, there is a claim that climate change is bigger than politics, in some ways it is, but actually the solutions have to go through politics somehow. And so I think that her Climate Targets posters really capture that fact that we can't, unfortunately, can't depoliticize this. We have to kind of go through the political struggle of convincing people who don't believe in climate change, or people who want to destroy things. You know, we have to somehow bring them along, and that's kind of one of the challenges that I find really interesting. It's like, how can we convince people that we don't agree with that we're right?
So so the book, so this exhibition is on, but the book is called How to Weather Together.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be due out in March 2026.
Yes.
And if you Google How to Weather Together, you'll see it come up on Bloomsbury website.
Yeah.
And you can pre-order.
Yes.
But basically, the idea is to come along to the exhibition, which is at Nerum.
Because the Black Gully Festival is on the Saturday.
On the 8th.
On the 8th. Because the kind of themes of art and environment are in, like, fundamental to the Black Gully Festival, and also obviously fundamental to the exhibition. It was good to have the exhibition open so people can come and check it out on the Black Gully Festival day. We also are having a stall called the Community Weathering Station at the Black Gully Festival. Should be fun. There'll be lots of little activities to do as part of that, and also what a great day that day is. The actual opening for that exhibition and the other ones that are opening at NERAM for the summer is the 14th.
And that runs to the 2nd of February. But come along to Black Gully Festival. You'll see it on the 8th and all those bits and pieces. It sounds fantastic. So basically it's art, these artists you've selected, it's their response to the notion of change and us changing, weathering, both as human species but also in the things that we do, and maybe mentally, and maybe some of those pieces of work might stimulate certain things in people, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm so glad that came across in what I've said to you, Herb, because I think this idea of almost like existential adaptation, right? Like, we obviously have to change practices, we have to change the economy, but we also have to somehow change ourselves. And what does that look like? Like, it's kind of an open question. And so in, like, climate change is obviously a bad thing we want to stop, but at the same time, there needs to be some sort of change process, because the situation that we're in the present is kind of causing climate change. So it's like, what do ourselves look like in an adapted climate change future? They might look, well, I hope, more connected, more caring, maybe healthier.
Well, I think we might wrap it up. It's been fantastic to talk to you, Jen Hamilton, from UNE and the Humanities, Arts and Social Science. And maybe we might get you back in to talk about feminism.
Great. I'd love to do that.
Well,
thanks,
I'd love to hear your view on it.
So much to say.
No, that's great.
Not today.
Not today. So come along. You've got the How to Weather Together. Come along to Black Gully on the 8th. There's a little stall down there, but you can go up to Nerum and see the exhibition. It runs from the 2nd of February. I think the official opening will be the 14th of November. And thank you, Dr. Jennifer Hamilton, for coming in. And that's Community Spotlight.
Thanks, Herb.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.